You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, April 12th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Cole Stangler, Paris-based journalist covering labor and politics, is here to talk about the French elections. And Amanda Chicago Lewis will also be joining us to discuss her piece in the New Republic. Legalized pot was supposed to help build black wealth in Los Angeles. It failed. Meanwhile, as Russian forces continue to pivot towards the Donbass region, Mariupol's mayor says that more than 10,000 civilians have died in the city. Even more civilians are on the brink of being without food, water, and communications. Philadelphia will reinstate its indoor mask mandate now that COVID cases are predictably rising. Expect more cities to do the same. This comes as China is experiencing its largest COVID outbreak yet. The New York Times is reporting that 6 months after leaving the White House, Jared Kushner received a $2 billion investment from a fund led by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Nothing to see there. And in a developing story, multiple people have been shot and at least 13 injured after a shooter in a gas mask and worker's vest shot up a Sunset Park subway station in Brooklyn this morning. Details are still coming out, still shaky. We'll let you know when we know more. New York's Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin was arrested this morning in a federal bribery conspiracy probe. It's alleged that he participated in a pay-to-play scheme with a Harlem real estate investor. Oklahoma's near-total abortion ban is set to be signed into law today by Republican Governor Kevin Stitt. The bill makes performing or attempting to perform an abortion punishable by up to 10 years in prison. No exception for rape or incest. And lastly, in Mexico, President Obrador has survived a recall referendum vote and will remain in power with his popularity still high. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. It is obviously still just me today. Sam. Yeah. Sam has succumbed to our bioweapon. No, just kidding. Not even succumbed. I was really joking there. Sam has COVID. And it stinks because he's been so careful about all, the precautions, and he really, you know, did a great job of avoiding it for a while, but it's hard to avoid. It's hard to avoid and keep living your life. So, sending him good vibes and hope that he continues to recover. It's just going to be me for the foreseeable future here on the show. We don't know when he's going to be able to come back, but whenever he feels up to it, he'll be back. So get well, Sam, for sure. But let's turn to this Joe Scarborough clip, shall we? Huh? In brighter news. Yeah, right, exactly. Joe Scarborough has a message for the, quote, white woke voters in Washington, D.C. This graphic has been making the rounds this morning because of how ridiculous it is. Here is his idea of how the Democrats need to approach the midterms in terms of strategy.
And Rev, I want to talk to you about a real blind spot that a lot of Democrats in the Beltway in D.C. have that you don't, and you've been warning about. But let's just say it right here, and let me say it slowly for my Democratic friends in Washington, D.C. Black voters are more conservative than you are. White woke leaders in Washington, D.C. Hispanic voters are more conservative than you are, white woke leaders in Washington, D.C. Asian American voters are more conservative than you are, white woke voters in Washington, D.C. And they're more conservative on crime. They're more conservative on education. They're more conservative on, quote, these woke issues. Get off of Twitter. I'm telling you. And Rev.
All right. Here's the graphic here. Midterm issues for Democrats. I wonder if Joe came up with it himself. Woke up as opposed to wake up. Get it? Do you guys get it? It's complicated, I know. Censoring of conservative voices on social media needs to be a midterm issue for Democrats. College campuses becoming liberal echo chambers. The push to be politically correct and canceling historical figures. Did Dave Rubin come up with this? Just keep going.
If you look at Biden, Biden runs against 15 progressives. Biden's the only moderate. Biden wins. We've said it time and again. Eric Adams.
Sorry, Biden was the only moderate in the field. I mean, I would even generously, there was two non-moderates, if you want to include Elizabeth Warren, which
right.
I have my problems with Elizabeth Warren. But yeah, I mean, insane.
Insane.
Adams runs as a conservative.
Oh, and here's some more. A furtherance of this graph here, midterm issues for Democrats, just to read this out. DAs in major cities going soft on crime.
Okay.
Bail reform in New York, crime spike in San Francisco. Again, like, crime is spiking absolutely everywhere. 2020, which is not to say it's like it's not a partisan issue. It's because there's a pandemic where people are
increasingly desperate.
Extremely, yeah, yes. A lot of desperation. In 2020, support for defund the police haunting Democrats.
There we go.
2022.
Yeah, even though there's no evidence to that effect. And even though we showed you last week on the show how the expiration of the child tax credit has essentially swung a bunch of voters, it doesn't seem, you can't prove exact correlation, but there seems to be exact causation, rather. There seems to be a hell of a lot of correlation for people whose child tax credit expired and people who are becoming more disenchanted with the Biden administration. But apparently that's defund the police.
Yeah, and the thing to know about that and why it's not emphasized here is that everybody in the Morning Joe studio likes that those kids are experiencing poverty. They want it that way.
Right. All right, good. Keep going. And I also just want to point out, Biden's like win, of course they're treating that as a referendum on everybody wants centrist policies. He won because Trump was such a disaster and the pandemic was such a disaster that people wanted anything normal. And that's why Biden was able to be elected. I can't prove it. It's a counterfactual. But if COVID hadn't happened, I don't think Biden could have defeated Trump. That's my opinion. But keep going.
He wins Brooklyn. He wins the Bronx. He wins Staten Island. Surprise. He wins Queens as a conservative, as a centrist Democrat. Mm-hmm. Can you please? I know you've done it a lot.
No.
Can you explain to white woke leaders? Can you explain to them that they're not only losing white dudes in the upper Midwest?
Who does he mean when he says white woke leaders?
He means like you and me on Twitter.
Really? I mean, are we in that? Are we in Morning Joe's head like that? I'm going to start making.
I mean, stay tuned. There's going to be a graphic of us coming up soon.
Yes, they're losing people of color.
They're losing people of color because they really don't get the people of color's life. If you are living in a city, in a neighborhood that is inundated with crime, and you act like that is not an issue, you've already lost me. That is an issue. Yes, we must deal with policing. I've been out front of that. But you cannot ignore when 12-year-old kids who somebody's niece and neighbor is killed, and you act like that's a non-issue because you're too elitist to live on the ground.
Yeah, nobody's doing that.
That's nobody. Yeah. This is like a modern version of hippie bashing where it's like, look at these white kids who want to defund the police. I mean, they ignore the tons of non-white activists who are participating in that, but they're saying white woke kids in D.C. I mean, I don't know who they're talking about because usually this is the criticism that's leveled at the squad, but you can't that they're most people. It's not all of the members of the squad.
Yeah, talking about Katie Porter.
Yeah, just Katie Porter. Right. Katie Porter is causing, wreaking havoc. And it's hard for them to make that claim with her specifically if they wanted to, because she's in a purple district herself. And yet she's still vocal about a lot of the issues that the squad is vocal about. So it's just like ridiculous. The concept that the idea that people are voting based on woke culture and cancellations. I mean, can we put that graphic up again just really quickly? The first one that he put up there. Crime and cancellations. That's what's okay. Here we go. Censoring of conservative voices on social media. College campuses becoming liberal echo chambers. The push to be politically correct. Canceling historical figures. This is
also just, how is the third bullet point any different from the first two? Like, they're just running out of things to put in bullet points.
Yeah, I mean,
the
like
push to be politically correct. That's implied under censoring of conservative voices on social media and college campuses becoming liberal echo chambers.
The echo chamber and the elites here are, that's you. That's you. It's you're just reading Barry Weiss's Substack and then pretending that's a broad United States electoral issue.
Yeah, a former Republican congressman and his wife, who is the daughter of a leading sort of foreign policy voice, basically the Democrat Henry Kissinger. Okay.
I hope instead of Medicare for all, instead of a Green New Deal, I hope all Democrats in this upcoming election cycle make sure to point out that college campuses are getting too liberal. That'll change the tide for Democrats.
Yeah. I mean, if people want to just see how a leftist, I mean, he's not a white guy, but a leftist talks about these sorts of crime issues. We had Paul Prescott on, who's a Democrat for state Senate in Pennsylvania, on Left Reckoning. And I would go check out his, because yes, it is an issue where rising violence, like people in communities do want that addressed. And if the right way to address that is more cops, or if it's investment elsewhere and different types of public safety stuff. But I would check out that for somebody who's actually running in a political campaign and addressing these things head on and not avoiding them, or just acting like he doesn't care, as the caricature is here with Scarborough.
Yep. And what did we say about this whole defund thing, right? I mentioned the thing about it, what's going to hurt Democrats most in the midterms is the fact that they lost on Build Back Better and they haven't passed any substantial legislation. What most people vote on is like strength and victories and good policy, yes, to an extent. But Democrats haven't been able to pass anything substantial. And that's because most of the Democratic legislators listened to the moderates and said, yeah, we'll be able to appease Joe Manchin. We just need a win now on infrastructure. And then you turn and you see the polling about the child tax credit expiring and how that's materially affected people's lives. And in fact, what do you know? The squad was correct. It had the opposite effect. People are turning away from the Democratic Party because there wasn't, at least are less enthused about them going into the midterms, because one, there wasn't a win, and two, something tangible that was provided for them was taken from them. And so they're going to have a bit of resentment about that. That's actually understanding people's motivations and understanding what affects people materially, as opposed to like college campus free speech. Talk about a warped perception of what elitism actually is.
The child poverty thing is a crime, and Democrats deserve to lose in a vacuum for that. It's an absolute crime that throwing that many kids back into poverty just because, I guess, Joe Manchin and the rest of the vampires in that party.
Yep. All right, folks, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll be joined by Cole Stangler, Paris-based journalist on the French elections from over the weekend. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. are back, and we are joined now by Cole Stangler, Paraspace journalist covering labor and politics. Cole, thanks so much for being here today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So, yeah, of course. The results of this round of elections in France, what are some of the major takeaways that you have as a journalist on the ground covering this?
Yeah, you know, I think you know, there's a lot of things to take away. Maybe starting with one, perhaps of more interest to your viewers is that the left outperformed expectations pretty substantially. You know, France is in a very particular political and media climate these days that's really dominated by the right, in which the main opposition that's sort of put forth by the press, by much of the mainstream press, and really by much of the political establishment for a variety of reasons, is the opposition between the centrist, center-right Macron, the establishment, and then the far-right, really toxic xenophobia represented by Marine Le Pen, who's the more mainstream vision of that, and then Eric Zemmour, who's a polemicist who got lower than 10% in the presidential election. In any case, so despite this sort of political media climate, the left did fairly well with Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who got 22% of the vote, overperforming polls, amassing a really interesting broad coalition that in many ways, despite the differences, is similar to the Bernie Sanders Corbyn coalition, composed of working class voters, left-leaning voters in cities that are more middle class, and then young people, big pillar of Mélenchon support. So I think that's one thing that if you want to kind of look at, one of the more positive takeaways from this election is certainly the fact that Mélenchon came very, very close to making it to the second round, about a percentage point or so behind Le Pen, who was at 23%, Macron at 28%. So now, we have this, this matchup between Macron and Le Pen. Maybe before going to that, just another quick takeaway here. You know, one of the issues that prevented Mélenchon from getting to that the second round is the division on the left. Which is something that unfortunately I've covered a lot and know a lot about it at this point, is over the last 5 years, the inability of left-wing parties for a variety of reasons to really work together. And in this case, the center-left parties deciding that they wanted to have their own candidates for particular reasons having to do with their own specific parties, so in particular the Communist Party, the Greens. And ultimately, that was the real difference maker here. For Mélenchon, if the communists had supported Mélenchon as in 2017, then he would be in the second round. So anyways, strong performance in the left-wing division. And now we're faced with this situation that a lot of people are dreading between Macron and Le Pen. I think people should be prepared for a surprise at this point. Macron is still leading in the polls, but he's seen his lead really dwindle over the last few weeks as attention has moved away from the war in Ukraine. And France is in a really dangerous place right now heading into the second round.
Yeah. I later in the program, we're probably going to talk about a U.S.-based journalist here who once said that Trump had no chance of winning the Republican primary, now saying that Le Pen has no chance of winning in the final round here, which is crazy. I want to get to the more doom and gloom stuff in a bit, but I did want to touch on Mélenchon and one, his policy positions. He supports a hike in the minimum wage, lowering the retirement age, and actual climate policy as opposed to the non-policy of Macron. And his overperformance, like, he's run before, and he didn't have the support of the Communist Party, as you say, or the Greens. There wasn't the coalescence behind him this time around, yet he still overperformed. What did he do differently in your estimation?
Yeah, I mean, I think, to some extent, this is sometimes used as a critique against him, but I think we should acknowledge it to some extent. Clearly, he was seen as what the French call le vote utile, so sort of the strategic, the useful vote is a literal translation, sort of the strategic tactical vote for the left. And he really surged in the end of the campaign because people who might not have been terribly sympathetic to him before saw the matchup that was sort of, you know, the risk of this Macron-Le Pen matchup, and decided to vote for Mélenchon because they saw him as the most viable left-wing contender. So he picked up some support, clearly, I think, from people who wanted to have the left in the second round, who might not have been all on board with all of his policies. And that's clearly visible if when you look at his support in some of the larger cities, where he did much better than in 2017. He almost won Paris, which is remarkable when you think about who lives here in this in the city today. He won Toulouse, he won Marseille, he won Nantes. So, you know, picking up support from these more, you know, middle-class, left-leaning voters who saw, okay, you know what, he's the only viable candidate, I'll support him. But of course, to get to that position, you need to have a real solid base to begin with. And Mélenchon did have a significant base of support from, I think one important element, without exaggerating it too much, is that, you know, we had this broad trend in the West of left-wing parties, nominally left-wing parties in some cases, losing support from working class voters. We see it in the US, we see it in the UK, you know, Thomas Piketty's research has looked into this as well. And we of course see it in France. Mélenchon does not capture all of working class support, but he was able to sort of conserve a significant chunk of support among working class voters. If you look at the exit polls, about 25% voted for Mélenchon, so higher than his overall total. So he had this base of working class support through his program, you know, talking about repealing Macron's repeal of the wealth tax, of putting back into place this wealth tax that Macron repealed, hiking the minimum wage, investing massively in public services. You know, these sort of bread and butter economic proposals, I think played a role in having this base. And he also is very popular among young voters, you know, in part, again, because of the climate issues that he really embraced, without the sort of mealy mouth liberalism that we hear from the Socialist Party. So really bold, a bold platform. And at the end of the campaign, he surged because he was seen as, you know, the one real viable contender. Maybe one last element I'll add, which is, I think, important, that doesn't really get talked about perhaps as much as it should in here in France, at least, is that, as I was mentioning earlier, France has this very toxic sort of political media moment that we're living right now, where the far right sort of culture wars are dominating public debate, constant hand-wringing over the place of Islam in France.
Right.
About French national identity, about secularism, about, we've had, unfortunately, this whole debate in France about wokisme, which is literally wokeness. So the place of sort of these woke ideas, and Macron's government has fueled these wars. In any case, Mélenchon, I think, was really the only candidate, on the left with a chance of winning who said, you know what, here's a different, who defended an alternate vision of sort of what French, you know, identity is today, which is that it's a multicultural nation built of immigrants, people who are, you know, descendant of immigrants. Yes, there are Muslims. Yes, there are Jewish people. And this sounds so simple to say, but in the French context today, where we are at sort of politically and media wise, I think it meant a lot. And that, I think, appealed to a lot of voters in ways that I think the French mainstream press just fails to understand, especially if you look at Mélenchon's support in the banlieue, which are suburbs of big cities that are heavily populated by immigrants and people that are descended of immigrants. And look at Mélenchon's scores were you know, fantastic. And if you look at the suburbs of Paris, like off the charts. So I think all this, you know, played into his success.
Right. And unfortunately, he did not advance to the second round. So now we have an Islamophobic candidate. And an Islamophobic incumbent who essentially, at the very least, right? I mean, and you can, if my characterization is unfair, let me know. But it seems like he has, Macron has essentially ceded that Islamophobia is necessary for him to have electoral success, has said, I think his interior minister said that Le Pen was soft on immigration, et cetera. Like he's pivoted to embracing some of this racist rhetoric. And so Le Pen's obviously a fascist, but he has legitimized a lot of that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a variety of things that we can look at to sort of illustrate that point. One is, we saw a law that they passed supported by the government that was initially called the Law Against Islamic Separatism, which they then renamed the law to, I think, Reinforce Republican Principles was the final title of it. This law was designed to supposedly crack down on the problem of radical Islam in certain parts in France, explicitly linking it to jihadism and terrorism. And it should be pointed out there have been a string of terrorist attacks in France that have sort of made this a real issue. Maybe it's not the most important issue in France, but there is this issue. And in particular of sort of homegrown jihadism. And that is a problem in France. Now, the issue with Macron's law is that a lot of human rights organizations criticized it for going too far, sort of linking even conservative forms of Islam to jihadism. You also had the government outlawing the primary coalition, the primary organization called the Collective Against Islamophobia. The government outlawed it. And so you have this real conflation of all these issues between, jihadism, Muslim separatism, conservative Islam, groups that are fighting Islamophobia, because supposedly in the sort of official line from the government and the interior minister you mentioned, talking about Islamophobia as a concept is seen as a way of legitimizing, the sort of Islamic separatist rhetoric. That's the line from the government. So there's this law against Islamic separatism. We've seen the law against the reforms to the immigration system, essentially make it easier to deport undocumented immigrants. We've seen hardline policies in Calais, which is in the north of France, where perhaps people have seen these images, horrific images of people living in tents. And in some cases, people dying trying to cross the English Channel going to the UK. You have people, essentially homeless people living in tents in Calais, and the government has repeatedly sent people in to tear up these tents and making public displays of them, and with the interior minister really, really celebrating this Darmana. So you have all that. You also have on this question of law and order. Again, Macron has really tried to position himself as sort of a law and order candidate, and painted his government as a real defender of law and order. We saw a particular law on national security that, in addition to enhancing government surveillance, featured a measure that fortunately was struck down by France's Constitutional Council, which is the rough equivalent to the Supreme Court. But this measure in particular that was defended repeatedly by Macron and Darmanin and his government would have made it illegal, criminalized the filming of police officers while they're in duty if the intent was to harm the officers, and people would have been subjected to fines of tens of thousands of euros. The government defended that proposal despite a lot of people saying, I think with good reason, that is a violation of sort of basic liberal principles.
How is intent measured except to use to crack down, right?
Unfortunately, the country's Constitutional Council struck it down. But I mean, and this gets into another issue, which is that Macron is often painted by much of the foreign press, not everybody, but he's often painted as a sort of liberal, right? A sort of classic liberal. And I think there is a fair argument to be made that when you look at a certain number of these policies, immigration and security, there's not a whole lot that's very liberal about this, especially when you're talking about, talking about that national security law. I'm a journalist. What the idea is that it's hurting my profession to be able to I can't take photos of police brutality. You're cracking down on the press, and so fortunately, journalist unions were helped fight fight this law and helped, you know, lead protests against it. But I think there's a strong case to be made that, you know, Macron is not really a liberal. He has liberal economic policies in many respects, in a sort of classically liberal sense. But when it comes to law and order, you know, he has a very sort of conservative bent. You know, I'll be careful about saying authoritarian because some people say that, but certainly a very conservative leaning bent on these sort of, law and order security policies.
So in this second round, that means that as you characterize it, and I think it's a fair characterization, based on my understanding, you have a center-right, neoliberal, free market, yeah, anti-labor, pro-cop incumbent.
Yeah.
In a time where there's a lot of anxiety globally and in France, where change might be called for versus Marine Le Pen, who now I want to get into a little bit, because it seems like she's, you know, she was rightly portrayed, I think, last time around when she did lose, as a far right candidate. She has fascist tendencies. She comes from a long line of this. Her father was involved in politics before her, also a right winger. And it seems like she's tweaked her rhetoric a little bit to be less explicit about her racism and a few more dog whistles. And, you know, you can tell me if that's accurate or not. But that, I don't know, is that enough to take her over the finish line to appeal to people if she's being a little bit less explicit about her right wing views?
Yeah, I mean, we've certainly seen in the campaign, the real anti-immigrant stuff, anti-Islam stuff is all in the program. I think she even more recently said that she wants now to ban the Islamic headscarf in public, so not just schools, which is already the case for high schools. I think with middle schools to high schools, excuse me. She wants to ban the Islamic headscarf outright in public. So that stuff's still there. It's in her program. You can read her program. She wants to have a referendum on changing rules for basically limiting the ability of foreigners to access benefits through the French welfare system. Affecting millions of people, some of whom are also coming from EU countries. So this is all in her program, but it is true that over the last, few weeks in the campaign, she's avoided some of the more inflammatory, explicitly, racist rhetoric that, her party has been known for in the past. And one of the big reasons for this is that she had the benefit of having someone, run even to the right of her, which was, Zemmour, who really helped set the tone for the debate. And so Le Pen was able to sort of play off Zemmour by saying, you know what, he's a little too divisive. He's very extreme. He wants to deport all the undocumented immigrants right away, immediately send them on planes immediately. He wants to ban people from having non-French names for their babies. That was something that Zemmour said. And so Le Pen could say, I know this is so dark.
No, it's disturbing how prevalent all of this is.
and so Le Pen, would say, well, this is too extreme. Listen, we do have a problem with immigration, but we need to be able to unite people. And so, she was able to play off Zemmour. And what happened over the last few weeks is that, she really turned her attention to, what's called in French the pouvoir d'achat, which is literally purchasing power, but sort of cost of living and broadly kind of economic issues. What's interesting is if you look at even her, her program, everyone in France gets these leaflets that are sent out to them ahead of the election of programs of every candidate running for office. If you open Le Pen's program, the first two issues that are mentioned in her program are what I just said, pouvoir d'achat, cost of living, and public services. So defending the French, I'm not sure if it's raised exactly public services, but it's the French social model she wants to defend. Of course, there's a racist, xenophobic tone to that because it's for French people. But nevertheless, she didn't talk about immigration. Those first two policy planks. And on the campaign trail, she's talked a lot about the cost of living. You know, she wants to lower taxes, you know, what she calls social charges. So the basic social security contributions, they're too high. So she doesn't want to raise the minimum wage, but she wants to lower taxes, and which would translate into wage hikes for people while also crippling the public sector, but that's another issue. You know, she wants to defend public services. And that rhetoric, I think, appeals at a moment in which we've seen the current government that, you know, has not given public services the amount of funding that they need to properly function. You look at the hospital system, you look at the education system. People have been complaining about this for years. And so Le Pen, you know, is able to sort of, you know, address her, you know, make a shift in discourse that I think is paying off. And she also, frankly, benefited from the fact that Macron wasn't really campaigning at all for the last few weeks. You know, he was, you know, there was obviously the war in Ukraine, and Macron was preoccupied with that. But in spite of that, there's a lot of resentment, the fact that he didn't want to decline to participate in a debate before the first round. And so there's really a sense that he's, you know, the sort of aloof, arrogant president. And in some ways, it sort of goes beyond politics. While Le Pen is traversing the country, going to small towns and saying, you know, I'm listening to you. Look at our, you know, president. He doesn't even want to debate me. And that stuff, you know, I think clearly has, you know, broadened her appeal. At the same time, let's not forget, I mean, she was one percentage point ahead of Mélenchon. And if you just add the French Communist Party behind Mélenchon, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. But right. Here we are. And it's also a testament to the anti-Macron sentiment that she's so close right now. It's kind of would have been unthinkable just a few years ago. She's about, you know, 4 or 5 points, depends on which polls you look at, but behind Macron with a chance at actually winning the presidency, which is remarkable.
I mean, it's not to compare too much to the United States, but like there are echoes of what we saw with Hillary versus Trump, you know, somebody who feels like the cachet of like, you know, being on the international stage, trying to make headlines for himself, frankly, attempting to broker peace unsuccessfully with Russia and Ukraine. And then somebody who's, you know, Le Pen is seemingly co-opting some of this populist rhetoric. I guess my question to you is, what is the sincerity about her commitment to some of these changes? Because it could be a way to, it doesn't seem like it is sincere. It could be just be a way to achieve electoral success. But I'm curious about your take on that.
I don't know. I mean, that's, you know, I think it's a hard question to answer, because in some ways, I don't really know if she's sincere or not. I think she wants to get elected. But I think also to be careful about saying that, you know, this is not a left-wing economic program. You look at Le Pen, she's against raising the minimum wage. She wants to raise people's pay by decreasing social security contributions, which is an old right-wing proposal in France. That has a negative effect on all the public services because you're defunding them. You know, it's like, I think Republicans talk about this when they talk about, we want to, you know, boost take home pay, right? They don't want to raise the minimum wage. They want to, you know, cut contributions to Social Security. At least that's a rhetoric that we've heard in the past in the US. She doesn't, you know, want a massive investment to fight climate change. She wants to get rid of windmills because they're annoying to farmers and ugly to look at. She doesn't, you know, it's not really there aren't really, you know, planks of her economic program that are that recognizable, to be honest. I think it's really, you know, coasting on this anti-Macron feeling. And you know, the frightening thing is, I mean, when you think about the second round that's coming up, and maybe this is different, well, you know, well, in some ways mirrors the, you know, the what we saw in the U.S. in 2016. I think the risk is less, and I think I'm already seeing, you know, the sort of discourse among a certain liberal-leaning Macron-supporting pundits on, you know, on the internet and articles they're writing, saying that, you know, the danger here is the, you know, sort of red-brown alliance of, we're going to see all these left-wing voters that are going to buy into Le Pen's program, and they just want to topple Macron, and they're going to vote for Le Pen. That is not so much of a risk, in my opinion. The bigger risk is that these left-wing voters, young people, working-class people, people that care about the environment, people that are that care about racial justice, although it would never be called that in France for a lot of reasons. People that are attached to anti-racism, you know, they don't feel compelled to go and vote for Macron. Some portion of them do, you know, don't feel compelled to go and vote for Macron because what they've seen over the last 5 years, and you know, it's sort of fresh in my mind because I've been talking to these people for a piece that I'm working on right now. But that's what scares me when you think about the potential election outcome. It's not that you're going to have people voting for Le Pen. It's more that people are sort of sick of having to pick the least worst of options, and in particular Macron, because they see him as the equivalent to Le Pen.
Well, and in terms of just if there's enough people that stay home, and there are enough people who peel off from Zemmour, right? The even further right great replacement theory candidate who got around 7%, if I'm not mistaken, that's enough to put her over the edge, is it not?
Yeah, I mean that's the big question. I think that's why the left wing electorate is going to be huge here. Because Le Pen presumably will get that support from the far right, the sort of like mainstream right, which I even hesitate to say mainstream right because they've adopted so much, you know, radical right discourse over the last few years. You know, some of them are saying they're not even sure if they're going to vote for Macron, although today former President Sarkozy said that he would be supporting Macron. But yeah, Macron is going to need this left-wing electorate, or at least left-leaning electorate. And I think a lot of the, and this is in a way, I just want to be clear here. I'm not trying to justify or encourage people to not vote. That's not what I'm saying. But if you want to understand sort of how Le Pen could win, this is the path. It's that these people don't feel compelled to vote. And there's a lot of them, and they also fit different categories. You have working class people that are hit by these economic reforms, you know, that can't get unemployment insurance anymore, unemployment benefits, because Macron changed the rules. You know, I was just talking to someone and they said they can't get these benefits because of the rule change. And you know, Macron, you know, rolled back taxes on the super rich, but she's still paying taxes. Like, does that make you want to vote for them? There's that. There's, you know, black and immigrants, black people, people of color and immigrants in France that feel disgusted by this rhetoric. There's like a big base of yellow vest resentment. And it's not these people are going to vote for Le Pen. I'm repeating myself. It's that I'm not sure these people are necessarily going to show up. And so what they're waiting for, what some people are waiting for, I think some of them could be compelled, is that, you know, if Macron could make some sort of gesture in their direction, some acknowledgement of the, you know, the situation that we're in today. And it hasn't happened yet. A lot of people are skeptical it's going to happen over the last 2 weeks. And this gets back into sort of his image of arrogance, of aloofness, of not wanting to admit when he's wrong. And
seemingly, sorry to interrupt you, unwillingness to tack left at all, but a very open willingness to tack right on a lot of issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And today, you know, I think, this week we've seen he seemingly suggested that maybe he's not, he's open to not raising the retirement age. So that was one of his big, really fascinating just political strategy, if I can say so, that before a campaigning on raising the retirement age. So he's now saying, well, maybe, you know, we could maybe reconsider instead of 65, maybe 64, maybe we can postpone it a little bit. So there's some maybe movement on that issue, but I think people are waiting for something a bit more. And I'm not really sure if we're going to get it because, you know, Macron's political strategy has really hinged around taking over the mainstream right and appealing to these right wing voters, and I'm not so sure that he's politically able to sort of make a move in the opposite direction really at this point. I mean, if you look at his cabinet surrounded by people from the right, his interior minister who was part of a far right youth group. You know, both of his prime ministers come from the right. His education minister is a, you know, right wing culture warrior. At this point, he's so locked into this that I'm not sure he's able to pivot leftward. But, you know, but we'll see. And in the meantime, the polls are just getting, you know, polls are tightening.
It's really terrifying. But I really appreciate your time today. Cole Stangler, Paris-based journalist covering labor and politics. Where can people find more of your work to read about this? And the final round is April 24th, right?
I'm not sure the exact. It's in Sunday from 2 weeks from now. I've been
okay.
So it's not next. It's not this coming Sunday. It's the following Sunday. Will be the second round, and you can find my work at colestangler.com, and hopefully doing some more election coverage here as the. I am doing more election coverage here as the as the next couple of weeks go on.
All right. Well, really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by Amanda Chicago Lewis on her piece about how legalized cannabis was supposed to help build black wealth, and it has not done so specifically in California. We'll be right back. We are back, and we are joined right now by Amanda Chicago Lewis, whose piece in the New Republic, Legalized Pot, was supposed to help build black wealth in Los Angeles. It failed. It's available now for everybody to read. It's excellent. Amanda, thank you so much for being here today.
Great to be here. Thanks for the kind words.
Of course. So let's talk about your piece. It's not just Los Angeles that a lot of these programs are being implemented. I guess before we get into, the specific person, Kika Keith, who you center your story around, I wanted to talk a little bit about, some of these, supposed racial justice initiatives in, pot legalization around the country, because we have some of it in New York, some of it in other states. In Massachusetts, where it's still rolling out here in New York, but it hasn't panned out in the way that the legislation said it was designed to do. So can you talk a little bit about that and just some examples from around the country?
Yeah, so these quote-unquote social equity programs that broadly attempt to atone for the racial disparities of the war on drugs through the legalization of cannabis have been, I would say, like all the rage the last 5 or 6 years, most of the places that are legalizing. So we see them in California. We see them in Massachusetts. In Michigan, obviously, it's having a huge influence on how New Jersey and New York are legalizing. It's happening in Virginia. It's happening in Arizona. It's happening in Connecticut. One of the people I spoke to for this story said, like, essentially you can't legalize without thinking about equity right now. And of course, after George Floyd's murder, this all accelerated, right? The sort of move on the part of politicians, but also businesses to signal that they care about racial equity. Do they actually care about racial equity? Often not. One of the people who I spoke to who cannabis legalization is an incredibly local issue, right? In order to legally sell or grow cannabis, wherever you are, you need a license from either the state or your city or county, your municipality. So wherever legalization has occurred, it's ended up being this kind of often political favor-driven process of giving out these licenses. Who gets to sell weed, right? And to be clear, having a license is not a ticket to wealth. There's sort of this illusion that weed is really lucrative. And it is if you're breaking the law. If you are selling legal weed, it is not that lucrative. So there's sort of been these like, we are going to offer generational wealth to mostly Black and brown people, but we can't explicitly say that because of affirmative action case law through these social equity programs by giving people licenses or offering a certain limited number of licenses to so-called equity applicants. In practice, what this has actually looked like is promises of wealth and far more people losing money in the pursuit of social equity licenses than are actually making money with successful businesses.
So social equity licenses are like the prerequisite essentially to for, you know, a Black or brown business to start selling weed. But I mean, like, if you don't have the capital to actually start your business, like most of these, you know, growing chains like Curaleaf and other cannabis businesses in the country have, how do you even really get started? Because you can't get a loan in most places because it's not legal on a federal level.
Exactly. So in addition to the fact that
not in most places, right? You can't get a loan at all. Exactly.
Exactly. So first of all, there's limited numbers of licenses. So maybe you have 1,000 people competing for 100 licenses. So 900 of those people are spending all this money, maybe on, you have to have a property in place before you can apply for the license, potentially. You have to have really elaborate, like, zoning clearance, security plans. You know, you have to get all of this stuff set up that costs all of this money before you can even be considered to get the license. Then when you have the license, not only are you competing against these giant chains with lots of money, but you're also competing against the illicit market. So it's kind of a bait and switch situation. Where do they get the money? A lot of people are describing predatory loans from whether it's investors who think generally the social equity licenses cost less to get than other licenses, right? Because the principle behind the thing means that they're like, oh, we'll make it more accessible, we'll make it easier for you to get this license, but it ends up being more expensive than, you know, the people who write the rules think it's going to be often. So maybe you're borrowing money from another cannabis company, but then they set up these elaborate contracts where you can only sell the other company's weed. Or if you ever decide to sell your business, you have to sell to that bigger company. So, you know, I had a lawyer in Los Angeles who was sort of reviewing several of these contracts that social equity applicants signed with investors in bigger companies and said it was some of the most predatory deals he had ever seen. And then also that's even people like, is the deal making it so that they actually are going to allow an equity applicant to run the business? A lot of times someone puts their name down to say, you know, they're the owner on paper, but in fact, behind the scenes, they're getting $35,000 a year to do nothing, not be involved with the business at all. And on paper, it says that they own the business, but in fact, they have nothing to do with the business.
So essentially, if you wanted to be an actually independent Black cannabis business owner, you would have to have a ton of capital that you get yourself, basically, that you already have acquired, which means that I don't know how that's necessarily promoting generational wealth in that way, because you're unable to get a loan. Or you have to sign away your rights to a larger corporation, or you have to go to a loan shark. So these are the options, because it doesn't appear like any of these social equity or racial justice programs within cannabis legalization offer grant programs, which would solve some of this, because then you would be able to get off the ground, right?
So there are so many programs that there are so many different things happening, that each place has its own thing. In Oakland, they have tried grants from the local government. However, when people were not able to pay back those grants because it's an extremely competitive market over there, and they're competing with the illicit market. There's been a lot of robberies and other crime against cannabis businesses, particularly in the Bay Area, particularly in the last couple of years.
They're all you can only pay with cash because, you can't pay with credit because of
easy target
on the federal level. Yeah.
Insanity. So Oakland offered grants to social equity applicants. When they weren't able to pay them back, they sent collections after those people.
Oh, all right. This makes me very mad. And you cite the statistic in your piece in terms of just like this fool's gold of promoting generational wealth. Black families since the Emancipation Proclamation have gone from controlling 0.5% of the nation's wealth to less than 2% during that entire period. And like that is that, I mean, obviously there's something wrong there, but that was one of the statistics that one of the most jarring statistics I've read in a while.
I mean, listen, I've been covering the cannabis industry in a lot of detail and legalization for like 9 years now. Researching this piece, which, you know, took maybe like 9 months to a year, and also, you know, is something I've been following for several years. Looking into the historical parallels, this is nothing new. This is exactly what the United States has been doing, particularly around promising property ownership, promoting business ownership, particularly among Black people, like since the Emancipation Proclamation, before that, but like in terms of, you know, 40 acres and a mule, just kidding, we're not actually giving you that, right? Like there's been so many examples. I mean, in my piece, I get into one of the biggest historical parallels, which is Nixon's Black capitalism program, which very similar to how social equity is playing out in terms of what was promised, the sort of political and business motivated social justice sheen that's being put on something when in fact behind the scenes, like, was it ever intended to really work? And why is it not working? And what are all the loopholes that businesses in particular are able to exploit, working around even the best intentioned governments?
I mean, it's just it seems like a really deliberate way to work around reparations, right? I mean, it's just we don't actually we want to control any Black wealth that's being created, and it's all got to be on our terms. And if it doesn't really work out, somebody's going to get rich anyway. And that's you have to have success within the narrow confines of like our capitalist expectations, and we're going to totally avoid and hide the ball on what would actually change things and repair some of this, which that's reparations.
Right. And then also, I mean, the cynical view is that it's been an intentional distraction to delay the new entrance to cannabis markets, because many of the folks that were licensed when only medical was legal in various places are predominantly well-capitalized white men. This is what we see in Illinois, in California, and so in Massachusetts. And so, you know, I had someone in the cannabis industry after they read the story was telling me, like, yeah, this was like deliberately. Those people got priority on licensing, which is what we're seeing right now in New Jersey. The folks who have medical licenses are getting early access to the recreational market, but they were licensed under a system that did not consider social justice or anything like this. And in the meantime, there's this slow motion equity process, which is filled with lawsuits and arguments and infighting. And meanwhile, all the medical folks have access to the market. Is it easy money for them? No, not necessarily, because having a license is not a ticket to wealth. You're still competing with the illicit market, and it's still very expensive to run a legal weed business. But it doesn't make it any easier for the social equity folks, especially, you know, in Illinois, we still don't have any social equity businesses I mean, and they legalized like 3 or 4 years ago. There's been so many rounds of lawsuits and arguments, and, you know, the people who were supposedly going to be the social equity licensees, you know, all this sort of, there were a lot of front people. There were a lot of, you know, it's actually this other company and they use this other person as a front. So it's a very messy business.
Yeah, I mean, and it's depressing because this was a really this was an opportunity for repair, and it just was not taken seriously in any way. I mean, and probably it's just that they actually didn't really want to repair it, honestly. Maybe that's the reality here. But before I let you go, I didn't want to move past the story of the person you sent her a lot of your piece on, Kika Keith. Do you mind telling her story a bit?
Yeah. So Kika Keith, you know, heard these promises about generational wealth in 2017 when, you know, then president of city council in Los Angeles, black guy named Herb Wesson, was, you know, speaking in predominantly black neighborhoods, talking about how legal weed was going to, you know, help the community and bring money into the community. She is an entrepreneur. She had previously started a company making a raw green beverage out of chlorophyll, with chlorophyll that was sold in Whole Foods. And she was like, I love this. I'm going to do this. And she spent 4 years trying to open that business, but also fighting the city and pushing to actually get what was promised to happen the entire way. The city did not enforce rules that it had put out there. The city kept delaying the program. And she just sort of took it upon herself to, you know, become a leader in that community. And she ended up being part of a group that sued the city and forced them to allow more licenses after there was a licensing round that was found in a city audit to be pretty corrupt. I mean, like, a lot of stuff went on that's really not okay. And, you know, it's also, there's just no, I think it's the big takeaway from all of this, because it gets very complicated. Weed policy is a lot more complex than, you know, you might think. The big takeaway is just because a business or a politician is promising some kind of racial justice initiative doesn't mean that they are actually intending for that to work. And it's often a very surface level promise.
Yep. Well, people, I don't want to give away everything in the piece because it's really well done. Legalized pot was supposed to help build black wealth in Los Angeles. It failed. You can read that in the New Republic. Amanda Chicago Lewis, thank you so much for being here today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, folks. With that, we are going to wrap up the first hour of this program. But first, Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
We did a think tank tomorrow. We're going to be talking to Kurt Hackbarth about Mexican politics. So check that out.
Nice.
Patreon.com/Left Reckoning.
I want to check that out because I'm curious about, you know, like a true leftist take on the results from yesterday.
Yeah, Kurt, we've had him on Left Reckoning before, so it'll be interesting to catch up with him.
Yep. All right. I'll be checking that out. Nomi will be joining us in the fun half, but
internet permitting, it looks like.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, you just messaged that to me.
Yeah.
All right. We'll see. Maybe she will be, but regardless, check out the Nomi Key show on YouTube, on Rockfin, Twitch, etc. I believe all those good places. We'll be taking your calls, reading your IMs. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
What is up, everyone?
Naomi Keene.
You did it!
Fun hack.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun hack. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7A?
Yes.
Me? You're safe?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No, stop. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start life.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this. Poop.
Call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the weak being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.